Hi, it's Patrick here with another World in Words podcast. Yep, we're on a roll. And we wanted to drop this episode before Election Day. It'll be a good listen after Election Day, but it's particularly pertinent before because, hey, there's a big language issue on the ballot in California. If you live in California, you probably know about it. If not, here are the basics. In 1998, a group of Californians collected enough signatures to get a measure on the ballot, a measure that would almost completely outlaw bilingual education in public schools, which was another way of saying no more teaching in Spanish or Chinese or any other language apart from English, but mainly Spanish. Well, the measure passed. Fast forward to a couple of years ago, and the California legislature, now overwhelmingly Democratic, with a large cohort of Latino lawmakers, the legislature decides to send bilingual education back to the voters. So now we have a second vote of the people, Prop 58 as it is on the upcoming ballot. And this one, if it passes, it would essentially overturn that previous vote. Bilingual education would be back. Much has changed in the past 18 years, and we're going to spend some time today on one thing that's changed quite a bit, something that informs how bilingual education is perceived in California, in the US, and beyond, and that is research. These past two decades or so have seen a tremendous amount of research done into the effects of bilingualism on the brain, on our cognitive skills, on our ability to learn and to make decisions. Ari Daniel is a science reporter with The Big Show, PRI's The World, and we asked him to find out what researchers now know and what they don't know about the bilingual brain.
Here's the question. Does being bilingual carry any advantage? And that question is, at least in the U.S., the subject of a heated discussion. It's not a simple pro versus con debate, says Thomas Bach, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Edinburgh.
If we approach a topic as complex as bilingualism, to believe that you can practically give a simple yes and no answer is, for me, quite naive.
Let's pull apart some of that complexity. A good starting place, says Judith Kroll, a psycholinguist at UC Riverside, is to know that in the bilingual brain, both languages are active at all times, even when just one of those languages is being spoken.
Bilinguals develop exquisite control to be able to master and regulate the use of the two languages.
That control allows bilinguals to switch between their languages, select one language while suppressing the other, and focus on what they're communicating in the moment.
The idea is that control isn't necessarily limited to language itself, but may spill over into other domains of cognitive function.
Like ignoring irrelevant information and paying attention to what's useful, or juggling different tasks. Kroll says these abilities can come online as early as 7 months for some babies, though not all. And Thomas Bach says there may be big payoffs for bilinguals much later in life, too.
I was involved in studies showing that people who speak more than one language have slower cognitive aging, have also 4.5 years later onset of dementia, and recover faster after stroke.
And some of these benefits may pertain not just to those who grow up bilingually, but also to those who learn another language as adults. These studies are part of a large body of work published over the last two decades that reveal an about-face in how we think about bilingualism in the United States. It used to be viewed with suspicion as an impediment to learning. Now it's the opposite, where bilingualism is seen as beneficial to some degree, though not by everyone.
Yeah, I think it would be fair to say that I'm one of the leading skeptics.
Recently, Ken Papp, a cognitive psychologist at San Francisco State University, has been critiquing the studies demonstrating bilingual advantage. He argues that the control required to master and deploy two languages doesn't necessarily transfer to other domains. He questions the demographics of the populations being tested. And he says that if researchers don't detect a bilingual advantage in a particular study,
they're likely to just place the results of their study in their file drawer and never attempt to publish it. Likewise, reviewers and editors, their typical reaction is, well, that's pretty boring, and those manuscripts are likely to be rejected.
Initially, Thomas Bach welcomed these criticisms.
Debate is healthy in science. It's necessary.
But Bach says that he and other researchers have responded to Ken Papp with studies that have nipped his complaints in the bud. Still, Papp's persisted in vocalizing and publishing his same doubts. Bach says it's time to move on. Yet Papp's not alone in his critique. Christiana Fellbaum, a computational linguist at Princeton, says there's conflicting evidence when it comes to the studies examining bilingual advantage.
Almost all experiments that I have seen are flawed.
Flawed, she says, in a couple serious ways.
The number of participants tends to be small. Virtually no two bi or multilinguals have identical profiles. So as a consequence, it's difficult, if not impossible, to set up a reproducible experiment.
It does seem to me that there are naysayers.
Psycholinguist Judith Kroll again.
Who are willing to take a couple of failures to replicate to essentially destroy the entire field, to dismiss all of the rest of the evidence.
To be fair, Fellbaum isn't out to destroy the entire field, and she says bilingualism may indeed have some advantages. So does all this back and forth amount to anything more than academic infighting? Well, the answer to that question is something folks agree on.
I think it's the potential implications for public policy decisions that we make as a society.
Our science, it is done in a society we live in.
And this is where we get to the election in California. A proposition on the ballot would reverse an initiative passed in 1998 that made bilingual education programs in the state's public schools a rarity. Ron Unz, a software developer and theoretical physicist by training, was one of the chief organizers of that campaign aimed largely at an immigrant Latino population.
The way to make a child from that background bilingual is for the schools to teach them what they do not know, which is English, than for the schools to just teach them what they already know, which is Spanish.
Wow, Ari, that's so interesting to hear Ron Unz now. I remember him back in 98 when that first proposition was on the ballot. And his view, it seemed to be the majority view of Californians, to get kids speaking and understanding English as quickly as possible. And that ballot proposition that he championed, that voters overwhelmingly approved it, didn't they?
That's right, 61% to 39%. And like you say, California was a different place then. There was still a lot of suspicion of bilingualism. And also, there was this belief that kids shouldn't be allowed to learn in their native language, that if they did, they just wouldn't learn English.
Right, right. So what has changed in the meantime? I mean, my sense is that there's more, possibly much more support for bilingual education these days, although we'll find out at the polls.
Part of it is that there's all this research that's been done that I've been telling you about that suggests a possible bilingual edge. That's so different from 18 years ago. Bilingualism is no longer a bad word. And also, California's demographics have changed. It's gotten even more multi-ethnic and more multilingual.
And what about the teaching methods? They've changed as well, right? I mean, there's been this great rise in dual language immersion schools where kids are taught, you know, whatever it is, math, science, history, in two languages, in English for part of the day, in the second language for the other part of the day. That model barely existed 18 years ago. That must have had an effect too, hasn't it?
Right, because dual language programs in public schools tend to be very popular among parents. Many have really long waiting lists. Now, that said, the ban on bilingual education in California has meant that there are actually relatively few dual language programs, about 400, which is just a fraction of the overall number of public and charter schools in California, topping out at more than 11,000. Mm. And here's the thing about California. In order to enroll your kid in a dual language school or in any program that teaches in a language other than English, parents have to sign a waiver, and that puts off most parents.
And if voters remove the ban on bilingual ed, no waiver.
That's right. Correct.
So what does the opposition to this ballot measure say, the people who want to keep the ban in place?
Well, it's best to turn back to Ron Unz here, who asserts that it's been a success.
The test scores of over a million immigrant students in California after 4 years increased by 30%, 50%, even 100%.
But some actually attribute these increases to score inflation that accompanied the introduction of a new standardized test at the same time that the law discouraging bilingual education went into effect. And there are findings churned up by this discussion surrounding bilingual advantage that may support bringing back bilingual education. For example, researchers have found some evidence that bilinguals are better learners. Take a study that Thomas Bach conducted with a group of Scottish elementary schoolers. Most kids in Scotland learn in English only, as you probably know, Patrick, but a small number of them learn in both English and Scottish Gaelic.
Kids who are taught both in English and Gaelic are better in English spelling than kids that are only taught in English. So kids who learn two languages, they're English spelling gets better.
And Bach, who speaks seven languages, says the debate over bilingual education, like the one in California, has little resonance in countries where speaking more than one language is unexceptional.
If we simply go across the world, we will find that in many countries, bilingual education or multilingual education is absolutely the norm with very good results.
Which brings us to an important point. The larger academic controversy over bilingual advantage occurs primarily in places where being monolingual is the norm, like the U.S.
The biggest opposition comes from countries where there is also a very strong negative attitude to bilingualism in the society, ingrained mistrust against anybody who speaks other language than their own.
And this casts the opposition to bilingual education in a place like California in an unfortunate light, says Christiane Fellbaum.
It comes down to anti-foreign sentiment and perhaps even racism. It's a very strong word, but I will use it here. People are anxious about immigrants, and there is a reasonably clearly defined target population.
Meaning the Latino community. Ron Unz, the one who helped get the 1998 initiative passed, says that's nonsense. And he says that if the new proposition being voted on does end up overturning the old one, he's not concerned.
Latino parents would be very unhappy, and they'd make a fuss about it, and the whole attempt would very quickly collapse.
So where does this leave us? California voters will let us know where they stand on Election Day. It'll take the research community somewhat longer to come to a conclusion. But Christiane Fellbaum, for one, even with her reservations over the extent to which bilinguals are advantaged, she always offers couples who speak different languages the same piece of advice on how to raise their kids.
I said, by all means, bring them up bilingually because your children will relate to both of your heritage and be able to look at the world with different perspectives.
And with that kind of openness, who knows, maybe those kids will be the ones to resolve long-standing, heated discussions.
Ari Daniel is a science reporter with PRI's The World. He's written a blog post for us on bilingual research. That's at pri.org/language. Hope you liked this episode. If you did, please give us a review at iTunes or wherever you listen. You know what? If you didn't like it, especially if you're still listening, good for you. And go ahead and write us a review anyway. Contact us on Twitter. We're at LingoPod. We're on Facebook. There's a World in Words page. And we have an email address. It's language@pri.org. www.ukraine.org. Thanks for listening. Have a good election if you're a U.S. voter. We'll be back in a few days.